Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
You know, you could get nothing worse than a six-year-old child being abducted and murdered. It doesn't get any worse.
Hi, I'm Jesse Mulligan, host of the Afternoons program on RNZ National. And welcome back to the second series of Crimes NZ. It's a podcast where I talk with people connected in some way or other with New Zealand's most notorious crimes. In this episode, I'm speaking to Keith Price. In 1987, he was a detective investigating the disappearance of six-year-old Teresa Cormack.
I think it was a big changer because of the circumstances, a young girl walking to school, the fact that it took 8 days before we found her, and then obviously 15 years before we got the offender. It was highly publicised throughout the country, and I've had feedback from a lot of people telling me that since that happened, they are completely different in the way they treat their children going to school.
There were protests at the time as well. I saw a photo of one on the West Coast in March, from March 1987. There's a placard that said, "Teresa Cormack, Louisa Dimadrin, your child could be next." So obviously it was making waves outside of Hawke's Bay.
Yeah, I mean, obviously because of the circumstances, it got a lot of publicity from us because we were, you know, when you've got a six-year-old missing, you're going pretty hard to get information so we could track her movements. And there was a lot of interest throughout the country. We obviously spread it around police districts to get suspects nominated and everything we could do.
And how much pressure was there on you guys?
That's a good question. And there's a lot of pressure on you because of what's happened. And because you're a policeman, you want to solve crimes like this as quick as possible. But you got on with your job. So it was a pressure job, but you were doing your job as well.
So to take us back to that time, we've got some audio, thanks to Ngā Taonga Sound and Vision. This is the principal of Teresa's school, Trevor Campbell.
We'll be discussing and explaining as much as we can to our children. I believe that our normal school day, as close as we can, will have to go on. But there'll be support for staff and for children through the day. We plan to start our day, as we have a large number of Māori children in our school, we'll be starting for the staff with a karakia, a prayer for to help and to support us.
And people were really scared, Keith, because actually they knew that the killer was still out there.
Yeah, that's really tripped down memory lane when I listened to that. And it just reiterates how big an impact it made on the community, which obviously affected the whole country.
Was it, highlight is not the right word, but one of the most memorable episodes in your career as a police officer?
Yeah, to arrest him would be one of the biggest results you could ever get. So satisfying after having gone through what we had with her.
You're not a police officer anymore?
No, I've been out of the job for about 16 years now. And this was probably by far the biggest crime I worked on at the latter part of my career.
So after the Jules Mekas was arrested or identified as the killer, was that pretty much it for you with the police?
I served another 2 years, but having had this sit on our plate for a while, it was I was never going to get an achievement and a result like this in any other crime. It's a very unique crime, and when I talk to other policemen, they agree. I mean, this is just out there. You know, you could get nothing worse than a six-year-old child being abducted and murdered. It doesn't get any worse.
What are you doing now, by the way?
I'm a city councillor with Napier City Council. And after I left the police, I went into the hospitality business for about 12 years.
Great. Where did you run? What was your business?
Thirsty Whale Bar and Restaurant in West
Kent. Yeah. Had some great nights at the Thirsty Whale.
Yeah, we're out of the fat and into the fire.
Okay, so let's go back then. Tough as it will be for some people to recall, here we've got a clip from Napier Mayor at the time, Dave Prebenson.
This shows an increasing deterioration in the social scene, and I'm concerned for the community safety, as it seems to show a steady downward trend right across the country. And of course it's focused on Napier at the present moment, but there's quite a bit of violence going on right throughout the country.
Do you think it's a problem specifically in Napier?
Well, I think it's coincidental that it's happened in Napier, although one must say that we've had our fair share of these events recently, with the two recent ones, and that's focused attention, but there is quite a bit of violence goes on in other areas in New Zealand.
Yeah, he was referring to a case 3 years earlier, Cursor Jensen. Were you involved in that one as well, Keith?
Yes, I was.
Really just a coincidence that those two cases happened in Napier, but both hugely high profile, huh?
They're two very big cases to have in one city. Yeah, well and truly.
And there's another case, another six-year-old, Louisa Damodran, who was kidnapped and murdered by Peter Joseph Holdham in Christchurch. That was just a few months earlier. We've got this clip of an interview with him at the time. Her father.
I really don't understand this could happen again. I just can't believe it. I really cannot believe it.
Has this search rekindled any memories of the search for Louisa?
Yeah, it's all over again. It's very hard to talk about it. It's like having a nightmare again, you know, same things all over again.
Has your child, Michael, said anything to you about Teresa's disappearance?
Yes, as soon as I was reading the paper, when he saw it in the paper, he said, it's the bad person has taken that girl away. He keeps telling me that some bad person has taken Louisa away all the time, and he thinks somebody's going to take him away too. And we keep saying, no, that will not happen. When I was reading the paper and he saw that girl's photo in the paper, and straight away said, it's a bad person, take that girl away.
What advice can you give Teresa's parents and parents of other young children?
Well, we know how they feel, and we are thinking of them. I'm hoping and praying that she's alive and she'll be found. And to all other parents, we feel that it is very important to take the children to school if they are very young, and watch them, because there's so many things happening.
Yes, Bob de Moderin, who is the father of six-year-old Louisa Damodran, who was kidnapped and murdered a few months earlier from Teresa Cormack. It's Teresa's case we're talking about today. Maybe let's begin with the search. So do you recall when she went missing, what sort of effort was undertaken to search for Teresa Cormack?
Oh, there was some phases set up where there was searching going around, and people running these, they were run generally by a sergeant, and they'd do areas around where she went missing, moving your way out, getting a bigger circumference around the point where we thought she'd gone missing from. And that was police, civilians, it was all hands on board.
No shortage of people wanting to help, eh?
No, sometimes it's hard to collate all the people that want to help. It's got to be organised and, covered, so you know where you've been and where you haven't been.
Was it one of those organised searches that eventually found her body?
No, she was found by someone walking along the beach, like 10 or 12 k's away out of town, Taranaki Beach.
Before we get to what happened when she was found then, let's have a listen to her mum, Kelly Piggott, going through about the worst thing a parent could ever go through.
If anyone knows anything out there, just let us know or inform the nearest police station. Doesn't matter anything, just so long as we get an idea where she is, or how she is or anything. Somebody must know something.
Are you optimistic she's still okay?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Incredible to hear that she was optimistic at that time, trying to believe the best for her daughter. So what do we know about that morning, the day that Teresa Cormack went missing, Keith?
I mean, I've firstly got to say it's quite fantastic the way she spoke for a mother in that situation. You know, that's pretty well done. I guess when the alarm bells went up, initially there's just patrols, you know, police patrols going everywhere trying to see if we can find her. Because initially you go through the missing person stage and then it becomes a little bit more suspect. Doesn't take long when a six-year-old's missing that you start looking pretty hard. But, you know, there's natural hazards that sometimes kids fall into too, so there's lots of options you've got to look at.
What do we know about what happened that morning?
Well, we know she left for school. I don't think she was that fussed on going to school that day. She'd had her birthday the day before, and we believed she would have got to school about 9 o'clock from our reconstruction, which subsequently was not right.
So can you explain that to us?
So she's walked around the streets for possibly an hour to an hour and a half, and we've got one sighting of a lady seeing someone in her little red raincoat approximately 2 to 3 k's away from the school, which has a lot more relevance with hindsight.
Right. So what do we definitely know about what happened, that she left home and never went to school?
No, she got to the school gates and then went walking. Exactly where she went, we can't be sure of.
And that was the only sighting, was it, that placed her a couple of k's away?
Yeah, which is one of those, when you know, like a young girl, and she had a really distinctive raincoat, which we publicised. We did a mannequin quite early with her clothing on, and we got that one sighting, which, as I say, has a lot more relevance now than what it did at the time. It's something that you have to consider, but it was a long way away from where she should have been.
And look, one of my kids is homesick and I forget to call the school, I'll get a text at about 9 o'clock or 9:15 saying that they're not there. But of course, there was no system like that in 1987.
No, that's correct. That's one good thing that happens now. But prior to this, it was just kiddies wandered down the street and went to school. It was never seen as there's any worries about them not getting to school. That's the change that's come into it. And now, as a result of that, as you say, there's safety points put in by schools.
And so when did her mum noticed something was wrong? When did she raise the alarm?
I probably would be unsure of the timing of that. I think it was pretty early.
Yeah, I've got 5:30 here, actually. 5:30, she called the police.
Okay, I can't confirm that, I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. So what do you remember then about your involvement at the time and where you started sort of looking to work out, who might have done this? I guess when you found the body, you realised what had been done and it became a murder investigation. But can you tell us a bit about that time?
So, obviously, we were looking for her and trying to get sightings, etc., for the whole 8 days prior. But then there was a report came in of a body on the beach, and Detective Sergeant Shapp, he was assigned to the scene and he went out and dealt with that side of the inquiry.
I understand he made a bit of a silent promise to her. Did you ever hear about that?
Yeah. No, he was quite open that he was going to get the offender.
And we've got the school principal, Trevor Campbell, again. This is how the school coped with the news that the body had been found.
We plan to have three separate assemblies throughout the school, one for our 5 and 6 year olds, one for our 7 and 8s, and one for our 9 and 10 year olds. And at that assembly, we will be sharing with the children the facts as we know them at a child level, and accepting that we all have a feeling of grief and pain with the news that we've been given through the weekend, and then advising them how best to handle that. And that's really directing them on the more personal questions back towards their parents, and in the general sense, with their teachers, and in the hope that we can continue as we did last week to keep providing the security in terms of routines that our children need through the day. We're also working in with Teresa's family.
fairly frightening thing for the whole school to have something like this happen. It must really bring home the dangers that children are facing.
Yes, it's had an effect on our whole community, as well as the immediate school community and the parents involved, but the broader community as well. And I've prepared and will be sending home to, hopefully, so that it will be of help to parents, some suggestions that we continue on as we did last week, where we had a very sensible and reasonable response from parents in terms of making sure that their children at the moment were under the care of an older person as they go to and fro, you know, within our community, and encouraging parents to continue to give the tremendous open support which they've given to the police, because there's still another part of this that isn't finished, isn't there?
I'm speaking with former Detective Sergeant Keith Price about the Teresa Cormack murder. That was the school principal from Teresa School, Trevor Campbell, talking about the news that the body had been found. So, Keith, where do you start looking for a suspect? How do you start?
Okay, so as soon as the button's pressed, shall I say, we go through dossiers, the police officers and people nominating offenders. I mean, people ring up and say, such and such to be an offender. So we then just start working through those people, interviewing, alibying. Just from recollection, we always try to get two alibis for every person, and it's a matter of just following leads. And a lot of people come forward with nomination of suspects. Some of them very good, some of them a long way off. But that's an assessment we had to make and work on.
And this guy, Jules Meekus, do you remember him?
Very well. I didn't deal with him initially. Detective Searle dealt with him and interviewed him. And with our reconstruction that we thought she went missing at 9, Meekus had an alibi with the social welfare, and that he had a meeting at 9:30, which he did keep. Detective Searle, to his credit, took blood and hair samples from Meekus, but the alibi for that timing was pretty solid.
Mm. You said earlier that that sighting 2 or 3 kilometres from the school might end up being significant. Why do you say that?
Well, that was later. I think it was between 10 and 10:30, that sighting, which at the time it didn't appear as though it would have been her. But as I say, with hindsight, it was probably pretty likely to have been her.
So what else is going on? There's a story here that Jules Meekus, had painted his car. You know anything about that?
He was questioned about that, and I can't take any further on that. I know he was questioned by, I think, Detective Searle questioned him on that. The sad thing about it was he had a really good alibi for that 9 to 9:30 period, or 9:45 period.
But was there not a thought that maybe, that she had gone walking and that it could have happened later?
At the time, we were of the view, I didn't do the scenes or anything, so I didn't do the reconstruction, which is always important that a reconstruction is done so that you do establish some boundaries. And there was nothing else to suggest that she hadn't got to school and then got abducted shortly after that.
Right. You're proceeding on the basis that she'd gone missing sometime just after 9 a.m.
Yeah. We're pretty happy. We were pretty happy at the time, or the guys doing the reconstruction, that it was around 9 o'clock in the morning.
And of course, DNA evidence was probably in its infancy, if it was even around in 1987. So, as you say, that Detective Searle had taken blood and hair samples from Jules Meekus, but there wasn't anything connecting him to the body, right?
No, that's right. And I mean, DNA wasn't sort of heard of in those days, but we did a lot of blood grouping, so you might have just got someone to a similar blood group,
yeah,
or a hair sample or something like that, which was nowhere near as accurate as DNA. Like it could give you 1 in 10 chance or 1 in 5 chance of having that same blood, depending on the grouping.
What do we know about Jules Meekus?
His parents were refugees. And he was born in a refugee camp in Auckland, I believe. He moved, my latter part was he had been living in Lower Hutt, and Detective Gary Orr had a lot of dealings with him. And he nominated him to us as a suspect, as he knew he had moved to Napier. So he had a lot of, Gary Orr had a lot of previous dealings with him that he immediately nominated him as a suspect for this.
He had done some other stuff, related stuff?
Yeah, there was a lot of sexual matters, peeping and peerings, which Gary was quite happy that he would be the type of person that could commit this crime.
That must have been a long 15 years before you finally got some evidence which would link Mikus with the crime.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I worked on it initially for, I think it was 2 or 3 weeks, and then I was required to go away in another operation I was involved in, police operation that is, not a... And then it was a long, long 15 years. It was great when we got news that we'd there'd been a profile obtained, and then there was a group of us set up to start working on suspects from that profile that had been obtained.
And was that just some new technology that they decided to apply to some of these cold cases?
So it was, DNA had become pretty powerful, and samples had been held from Teresa, and then the ESR, in discussion with Shabby, who was there from day one, decided that they would see what they could do with these samples, and subsequently got the profile.
Of Jules Mikus?
Yes.
Of 60 million times, yeah, 60 million times more likely to be him than from any other randomly selected male.
Yep, that's dead right. Yep. So it was quite, it was exciting for us, you know, to think that we've at least got a line of inquiry, and we spent, I think before we got Jules, it was 4 or 5 months going through suspects lists, obtaining blood, comparing, and just 5 or 6 of us doing that every day for quite some time.
Why were you doing that if you had that match?
We only had the match of the offender. So after we went through the suspects and Mikus was on there, but then we made the decision that we would, any samples that we'd taken over the whole time would be put in to be to check through in a comparison.
And so do you remember making the decision to visit him, arrest him?
I can remember going to Wellington to arrest him with Shabby. We went 2 or 3 days before it, and I can still remember the morning of walking into his house and taking him away.
What was his reaction?
He was, how would you put it, he's a very cold man. He was not flustered. He came with us by consent back to the Leichhardt police station and just didn't show any emotion whatsoever.
In fact, there's a story that his partner at the time was with him when it came on the news that they'd found a match in the Teresa Cormack case, and she reported that he was pretty cool at that moment as well.
He was very cool, but he's a unique sort of guy. He's very cold, emotionless, doesn't talk a lot, and should be very accurate in that comment.
So you were pleased to have what looked like your man, not as pleased, I suppose, as Teresa's mum.
Oh, it was pretty good for Kelly. It gave some, probably the closure that she needed. She'd been pretty strong over the whole incident and very supportive and helpful, and it was good to be able to tell her that we'd arrested the offender.
Have you stayed in touch with her, by the way?
I haven't seen her for a long time. I do every now and again catch up with her, but not for some time now.
She got any other kids?
Yeah, there was a sister. Younger sister.
Okay. So you're pretty sure you've got your man now. Do you interview him? Does he give anything away, or does he force you really to use the DNA evidence you've got to convict him?
Okay. So the DNA was that powerful that we had him. We had 2 samples, and both separately examined and came back as him. We interviewed him for the best part of a day, and he just had no movement whatsoever in admitting to any offences, just saying it wasn't him. We had the wrong person. And a couple of times there, because he's so quiet and cold, you weren't sure, but you thought, oh, maybe he's going to come across. But no, he didn't give any admissions whatsoever.
Mm.
When we explained to him that, you know, how the DNA had him, we knew he was the offender. There was no outs, and he just didn't even move on that. We thought he might have given some sort of, something to the parents, but no, nothing at all.
So he pled not guilty, and you went to a jury trial. Were you worried it might not stick?
No, he went to a voir dire and tested our case. On my interview, he tested the blooding that we'd done, tested, because we re-blooded him, took blood from him again once we'd arrested him. And I've got to say, I had the book with me to make sure it was exactly right. And then he went to trial, and if ever there's a case you should plead guilty on, that was it. He was without an admission, but the things that had come out, he was in the area, so that makes even the figures you quote of 60 million even more powerful. But he's stuck to his denials all the way, and every 10 years, I think it was after 10 years, he came up for parole, but parole board wouldn't even entertain him because he showed no remorse whatsoever. And probably that was a blessing in the way, because you wouldn't want him back on the streets.
What must he have done in that 15 years since? Had he been in trouble? Had he been to jail for other stuff? It's hard to imagine he would go through with a crime like that and not do something else similar.
He had done some things, but I don't think he'd been to jail. And I would say, from the circumstances of some of the feedback from the life he had lived, he would have re-offended in ways that probably didn't come to us. He'd had partners with children, but that's probably an area that, you speculate on.
He's dead now.
Yes. I got called about him when he was found that he had a brain hemorrhage and that he was going to die for comments. And it's very difficult to be able to probably be really honest about what I think about that.
Yeah, I can understand that. So how do you think about this case now?
Oh, it's so sad. I mean, we lived her in our office. We had a photo of her up on the walls because she was a pretty young girl. And with the mannequin of her in her gear, that red raincoat, I always remember it. It's just so sad, so sad. I don't think, like for Kelly, she'd never get over this. And it did change our country, I believe it did.
You've been listening to Crimes NZ with me, Jesse Mulligan. Now you can find more episodes in this series on the RNZ Podcasts page. It's also on Apple, Spotify, iHeart, and wherever you catch your favourite podcasts. Don't forget to follow the series, and if you enjoyed it, give it a rating to help others find it too. When you've finished this series and you're looking for the next great listen, try Gone Fishing or Black Sheep. They're both award-winning true crime podcasts from RNZ. Thanks for listening to Crimes NZ. I'm Jesse Mulligan.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.